so hard the communal eyeball popped right out of her socket. Wasp snatched it, and with a terrible show of fumbling, intentionally chucked it over her shoulder right into my lap. I screamed. The sisters screamed too. Anger, now bereft of guidance, swerved all over the road, sending my stomach into my esophagus.
"He's stolen our eye," cried Tempest. "We can't see."
"I have not," I yelped. "It's disgusting." Meg whooped with pleasure.
"This is so cool."
"Get it off," I squirmed and tilted my hips, hoping the eye would roll away. But it stayed stubbornly in my lap, staring up at me with the accusatory glare of a dead catfish. Meg did not help. Clearly, she didn't want to do anything that might interfere with the coolness of us dying in a faster-than-light car crash.
"He will crush our eye," Anger cried, "if we don't recite our verses."
"I will not."
"We will all die," Wasp said. "He is crazy."
"I am not."
"Fine, you win,"
Tempest howled. She drew herself up and recited as if performing for the people in Connecticut 10 miles away.
"A dare reveals the path that was unknown,"
Anger chimed in.
"And bears destruction, lion, snake entwined,"
Wasp concluded.
"Or else the princeps never be your throne."
Meg clapped. I stared at the Gray Sisters in disbelief. That wasn't doggerel. That was Terzarima. You just gave us the next stanza of our actual prophecy.
"Well, that's all we've got for you,"
Anger said.
"Now give me the eye, quick. We're almost at camp."
Panic overcame my shock. If Anger couldn't stop at our destination, we'd accelerate past the point of no return and vaporize in a colorful streak of plasma across Long Island. And yet, that still sounded better than touching the eyeball in my lap. "Meg? Kleenex?" She snorted. "Wimp." She scooped up the eye with her bare hand and tossed it to Anger. Anger shoved the eye in her socket. She blinked at the road, yelled,
"Yikes!"
and slammed on the brakes so hard my chin hit my sternum. Once the smoke cleared, I saw we had skidded to a stop on the old farm road just outside of camp. To our left loomed Half-Blood Hill, a single great pine tree rising from its summit, the golden fleece glittering from the lowest branch. Coiled around the base of the tree was Peleus the dragon. And standing next to the dragon, casually scratching its ears, was an old frenemy of mine, Dionysus, the god of doing things to annoy Apollo. 8. I am Mr. A. I am here to fix toilets and also pass out. Perhaps that last comment was unfair. Dionysus was the god of other things, such as wine, madness, Oscar night after parties, and certain types of vegetation. But to me, he would always be the annoying little brother who followed me around, trying to get my attention by imitating everything I did. You know the type. You're a god, your little brother pesters dad to make him a god too, even though being a god is supposed to be your thing. You have a nice chariot pulled by fiery horses. Your little brother insists on getting his own chariot pulled by leopards. You lay waste to the Greek armies at Troy. Your little brother decides to invade India. Pretty typical stuff. Dionysus stood at the top of the hill as if he'd been expecting us. Being a god, maybe he had. His leopard skin golf shirt matched the golden fleece in the branch above him quite well. His mauve golf slacks did not. In the old days, I might have teased him about his taste in clothes. Now I couldn't risk it. A lump formed in my throat. I was already carsick from our taxi ride and our impromptu game of catch the eyeball. My wounded forehead throbbed. My brain swirled with the new lines of prophecy the Gray Sisters had given us. I didn't need any more things to worry about. But seeing Dionysus again? This would be complicated. Meg slammed the taxi door behind her.
Thanks, guys, she told the Gray Sisters. Next time, tell me about the dog.
Without so much as a goodbye or a plea to share their poetry with my literary agent, the Gray Sisters submerged in a pool of black-red tar. Meg squinted up at the hill's summit.
Who's that guy? We didn't meet him before.
She sounded suspicious, as if he were intruding on her territory. That, I said, is the god Dionysus. Meg frowned.
Why?
She might have meant, why is he a god? Why is he standing up there? Or why is this our life? All three questions were equally valid.
I don't know, I said. Let's find out.
Trekking up the hill, I fought the urge to burst into hysterical sobbing or laughter. Probably I was going into shock. It had been a rough day, and it wasn't even lunchtime yet. However, given the fact that we were approaching the god of madness, I had to consider the more serious possibility that I was having a psychotic or manic break. I already felt disconnected from reality. I couldn't concentrate. I didn't know who I was, who I was supposed to be, or even who I wanted to be. I was getting emotional whiplash from my exhilarating surges of godlike power, my depressing crashes back into mortal frailty, and my adrenaline-charged bouts of terror. In such a condition, approaching Dionysus was asking for trouble. Just being near him could widen the cracks in anyone's psyche. Meg and I reached the summit. Peleus welcomed us with a puff of steam from his nostrils. Meg gave the dragon a hug around the neck, which I'm not sure I would have recommended. Dragons are notoriously not huggers. Dionysus eyed me with a mixture of shock and horror, much the same way I looked at myself in the mirror these days.
So it's true what father did to you, he said. That cold-hearted Glamon.
In ancient Greek, Glamon meant something like dirty old man. Given Zeus's romantic track record, I doubted he would even consider it an insult. Dionysus gripped my shoulders. I didn't trust myself to speak. He looked the same as he had for the past half century. A short, middle-aged man with a pot belly, sagging jowls, a red nose, and curly black hair. The violet tint of his irises was the only indicator that he might be more than human. Other Olympians could never comprehend why Dionysus chose this form when he could look like anything he wanted. In ancient times, he'd been famous for his youthful beauty that defied gender. But I understood. For the crime of chasing the wrong nymph, translation, one our father wanted instead, Dionysus had been sentenced to run this camp for 100 years. He had been denied wine, his most noble creation, and forbidden access to Olympus except for special meeting days. In retaliation, Dionysus had decided to look and act as ungodly as possible. He was like a child refusing to tuck in his shirt, comb his hair, or brush his teeth, just to show his parents how little he cared.
Poor, poor Apollo.
He hugged me. His hair smelled faintly of grape-flavored bubblegum. This unexpected show of sympathy brought me close to tears, until Dionysus pulled away, held me at arm's length, and gave me a triumphant smirk.
Now you understand how miserable I've been, he said. Finally, someone got punished even more harshly than me.
I nodded, swallowing back a sob. Here was the old on-brand Dionysus I knew and didn't exactly love.
Yes. Hello, brother. This is Meg.
Don't care.
Dionysus's eyes remained fixed on me, his tone infused with joy. Humph. Meg crossed her arms. Where's Chiron? I liked him better.
Who? Dionysus said. Oh, him. Long story. Let's get you into camp, Apollo. I can't wait to show you off to the demigods. You look horrible.
We took the long way through camp. Dionysus seemed determined to make sure everyone saw me.
This is Mr. A,
he told all the newcomers we encountered.
He's my assistant. If you have any complaints or problems, toilets, backing up or whatnot, talk to him.
Could you not? I muttered. Dionysus smiled.
If I am Mr. D, you can be Mr. A.
He's Lester, Meg complained, and he's my assistant. Dionysus ignored her.
Oh, look, another batch of first-year campers. Let's go introduce you.
My legs were wobbly. My head ached. I needed lunch, rest, antibiotics, and a new identity. Not necessarily in that order. But we trudged on. The camp was busier than it had been the winter when Meg and I first straggled in. Then only a core group of year-rounders had been present. Now waves of newly discovered demigods were arriving for the summer. Dozens of dazed kids from all over the world, many still accompanied by the satyrs who had located them. Some demigods, who evidently had recently fought off monsters, were injured even worse than I was, which I suppose is why Meg and I didn't get more stares. We made our way through the camp's central green. Around its edges, most of the 20 cabins buzzed with activity. Senior counselors stood in the doorways, welcoming new members or providing directions. At the Hermes cabin, Julia Feingold looked especially overwhelmed, trying to find temporary spots for all the campers still unclaimed by their godly parents. At the Ares cabin, Sherman Yang barked at anyone who got too close to the building, warning them to look out for the landmines around the perimeter. Whether or not that was a joke, no one seemed anxious to find out. Young Harley from the Hephaestus cabin dashed around with a huge grin on his face, challenging the newbies to arm wrestling contests. Across the green, I spotted two of my own children, Austin and Kayla. But as much as I wanted to talk with them, they were embroiled in some sort of conflict resolution between a group of security harpies and a new kid who had apparently done something the harpies didn't like. I caught Austin's words. No, you can't just eat a new camper. They get two warnings first. Even Dionysus didn't want to get involved in that conversation. We kept walking. The damage from our wintertime battle against Nero's Colossus had been mostly repaired, though some of the dining hall's columns were still broken. Nestled between two hills was a new pond in the shape of a giant's footprint. We passed the volleyball court, the sword-fighting arena, and the strawberry fields, until finally Dionysus took pity on me and led us to camp headquarters. Compared to the camp's Greek temples and amphitheaters, the four-story, sky-blue Victorian, known as the Big House, looked quaint and homey. Its white trim gleamed like cake frosting. Its bronze eagle weather vane drifted lazily in the breeze. On its wraparound front porch, enjoying lemonade at the card table, sat Nico D'Angelo and Will Solis. Dad! Will shot to his feet. He ran down the steps and tackled me in a hug. That's when I lost it. I wept openly. My beautiful son, with his kind eyes, his healer's hands, his sun-warm demeanor. Somehow, he had inherited all my best qualities and none of the worst. He guided me up the steps and insisted I take his seat. He pressed a cold glass of lemonade into my hands, then started fussing over my wounded head. I'm fine, I murmured.
though clearly I wasn't. His boyfriend, Nico D'Angelo, hovered at the edge of our reunion, observing, keeping to the shadows as children of Hades tend to do. His dark hair had grown longer. He was barefoot in tattered jeans and a black version of the camp's standard t-shirt, with a skeletal Pegasus on the front, above the words Cabin 13.
"Meg," Nico said, "take my chair. Your leg looks bad."
He scowled at Dionysus, as if the god should have arranged a golf cart for us.
"Yes, fine, sit."
Dionysus gestured listlessly at the card table.
"I was attempting to teach Will and Nico the rules of Pinochle, but they're hopeless."
"Oh, Pinochle," Meg said. "I like Pinochle."
Dionysus narrowed his eyes as if Meg were a small dog who had suddenly begun to spout Emily Dickinson.
"Is that so? Wonders never cease."
Nico met my gaze, his eyes pools of ink.
"So, is it true? Is Jason..."
"Nico," Will chided, "don't pressure him." The ice cubes shook in my glass. I couldn't make myself speak, but my expression must have told Nico everything he needed to know. Meg offered Nico her hand. He took it in both of his. He didn't look angry exactly. He looked as if he'd been hit in the gut not just once, but so many times over the course of so many years that he was beginning to lose perspective on what it meant to be in pain. He swayed on his feet. He blinked. Then he flinched, jerking his hands away from Meg's, as if he'd just remembered his own touch was poison.
"Hi," he faltered. "Scusatemi."
He hurried down the steps and across the lawn, his bare feet leaving a trail of dead grass. Will shook his head. "He only slips into Italian when he's really upset."
"The boy has had too much bad news already,"
Dionysus said with a tone of grudging sympathy. I wanted to ask what he meant about bad news. I wanted to apologize for bringing more trouble. I wanted to explain all the tremendous and spectacular ways I had failed since the last time I had seen Camp Half-Blood. Instead, the lemonade glass slipped from my fingers. It shattered on the floor. I tipped sideways in my chair as Will's voice receded down a long, dark tunnel.
"Dad! Guys, help me!"
Then I spiraled into unconsciousness. 9. Breakfast is the meal, with pancakes and burnt yogurt. And insanity. Bad dreams? Sure, why not? I suffered a series of Instagram boomerang nightmares. The same short scenes looped over and over. Luguselwa hurtling over a rooftop. The Amphisbina staring at me in bewilderment as two crossbow bolts pinned his necks to the wall. The Gray Sister's eyeball flying into my lap and sticking there like it was coated in glue. I tried to channel my dreams in a more peaceful direction. My favorite beach in Fiji. My old festival day in Athens. The gig I played with Duke Ellington at the Cotton Club in 1930. Nothing worked. Instead, I found myself in Nero's throne room. The loft space took up one whole floor of his tower. In every direction, glass walls looked out over the spires of Manhattan. In the center of the room, on a marble dais, the emperor sprawled across a gaudy velvet couch throne. His purple satin pajamas and tiger-striped bathrobe would have made Dionysus jealous. His crown of golden laurels sat askew on his head, which made me want to adjust the neck beard that wrapped around his chin like a strap. To his left stood a line of young people. Demigods, I assumed. adopted members of the imperial family like Meg had been. I counted 11 in all, arranged from tallest to shortest, their ages ranging from about 18 to 8. They wore purple-trimmed togas over their motley assortment of street clothes to indicate their royal status. Their expressions were a case study in the results of Nero's abusive parenting style. The youngest seemed struck with wonder, fear, and hero worship. The slightly older ones looked broken and traumatized, their eyes hollow. The adolescents showed a range of anger, resentment, and self-loathing, all bottled up and carefully not directed at Nero. The oldest teens looked like mini Neros, cynical, hard, cruel junior sociopaths. I could not imagine Meg McCaffrey in that assembly. And yet I couldn't stop wondering where she would fall in the line of horrific expressions. Two Germani lumbered into the throne room carrying a stretcher. On it lay the large, battered form of Luguselva. They set her down at Nero's feet, and she let out a miserable groan. At least she was still alive.
"The hunter returns empty-handed," Nero sneered. "Plan B it is, then. A 48-hour ultimatum seems reasonable."
He turned to his adopted children.
"Lucius, double security at the storage vats. Emilia, send out invitations. And order a cake. Something nice. It's not every day we get to destroy a city the size of New York."
My dream self plummeted through the tower into the depths of the earth. I stood in a vast cavern. I knew I must be somewhere beneath Delphi, the seat of my most sacred oracle. Because the soup of volcanic fumes swirling around me smelled like nothing else in the world, I could hear my arch nemesis, Python, somewhere in the darkness, dragging his immense body over the stone floor.
"You still do not see it."
His voice was a low rumble.
"Oh, Apollo, bless your tiny, inadequate brain. You charge around, knocking over pieces, but you never look at the whole board. A few hours at most. That is all it will take once the last pawn falls. And you will do the hard work for me."
His laughter was like an explosion sunk deep into stone, designed to bring down a hillside. Fear rolled over me until I could no longer breathe. I woke feeling like I'd spent hours trying to squirm out of a stone cocoon. Every muscle in my body ached. I wished I could just once wake up refreshed after a dream about getting seaweed wraps and pedicures with the nine muses. Oh, I missed our spa decades. But no, I got sneering emperors and giant laughing reptiles instead. I sat up, woozy and blurry-eyed. I was lying in my old cot in the me cabin. Sunlight streamed through the windows. Morning light? Had I really slept that long? Snuggled up next to me, something warm and furry was growling and snuffling in my pillow. At first glance, I thought it might be a pit bull, though I was fairly sure I did not own a pit bull. Then it looked up, and I realized it was the disembodied head of a leopard. One nanosecond later, I was standing at the opposite end of the cabin, screaming. It was the closest I'd come to teleporting since I'd been a god. "Oh, you're awake!" My son Will emerged from the bathroom in a billow of steam, his blonde hair dripping wet and a towel around his waist. On his left pectoral was a stylized sun tattoo, which seemed unnecessary to me, as if he could be mistaken for anything but a child of the sun god. He froze when he registered the panic in my eyes. "What's wrong?"
"Grrr,"
said the leopard. Seymour? Will marched over to my cot and picked up the leopard head, which at some point in the distant past had been taxidermied and stuck on a plaque, then liberated from a garage sale by Dionysus and granted new life. Normally, as I recalled, Seymour resided over the fireplace mantle in the big house, which did not explain why he had been chewing on my pillow. "What are you doing here?" Will demanded of the leopard. Then to me, "I swear I did not put him in your bed."
"I did."
Dionysus materialized right next to me. My tortured lungs could not manage another scream, but I leaped back an additional few inches. Dionysus gave me his patented smirk.
"I thought you might like some company. I always sleep better with a teddy leopard."
"Very kind." I tried my best to kill him with eye daggers, but I prefer to sleep alone.
"As you wish. Seymour, back to the big house."
Dionysus snapped his fingers, and the leopard head vanished from Will's hands.
"Well then," Dionysus studied me, "feeling better after 19 hours of sleep?"
I realized I was wearing nothing but my underwear. With my pale, lumpy, mortal form covered in bruises and scars, I looked less than ever like a god, and more like a grub that had been pried from the soil with a stick.
"Feeling great," I grumbled.
"Excellent. Will, get him presentable. I'll see you both at breakfast."
"Breakfast?" I said in a daze.
"Yes," Dionysus said. "It's the meal with pancakes. I do love pancakes."
He disappeared in a grape-scented cloud of glitter. "Such a show-off," I muttered. Will laughed. "You really have changed. I wish people would stop pointing that out."
"It's a good thing."
I looked down again at my battered body.
"If you say so.
Do you have any clothing or possibly a burlap sack I might borrow?" Here's all you need to know about Will Solace. He had clothes waiting for me. On his last trip into town, he'd gone shopping specifically for things that might fit me.
"I figured you'd come back to camp eventually," he said.
"I hoped you would anyway. I wanted you to feel at home." It was enough to start me crying again. Gods, I was an emotional wreck. Will hadn't inherited his thoughtfulness from me. That was all his mother, Naomi. Bless her kind heart. I thought about giving Will a hug, but since we were clad in just underwear and a towel, respectively, that seemed awkward. He patted me on the shoulder instead. "Go take a shower," he advised. "The others took an early morning hike." He gestured at the empty bunks, "but they'll be back soon. I'll wait for you." Once I was showered and dressed in a fresh pair of jeans and a V-necked olive tee, both of which fit perfectly, Will rebandaged my forehead. He gave me some aspirin for my aching everything. I was starting to feel almost human again, in a good way, when a conch horn sounded in the distance, calling the camp to breakfast. On our way out of the cabin, we collided with Kayla and Austin, just returning from their hike with three younger campers in tow. More tears and hugs were exchanged.
"You've grown up."
Kayla gripped my shoulders with her archery-strong hands. The June sunlight made her freckles more pronounced. The green-tinted tips of her orange hair made me think of Halloween pumpkin candy.
"You're 2 inches taller, at least. Isn't he, Austin?"
"Definitely," Austin agreed. As a jazz musician, Austin was usually smooth and cool, but he gave me a serene smile, like I'd just nailed a solo worthy of Ornette Coleman. His sleeveless orange camp tee showed off his dark arms. His cornrows were done in swirls like alien crop circles. "It's not just the height," he decided.
It's the way you hold yourself.
Ahem, said one of the kids behind him. Oh, right. Sorry, guys.
Austin stepped aside.
We got 3 new campers this year, Dad. I'm sure you remember your children, Gracie and Jerry and Jan. Guys, this is Apollo.
Austin introduced them casually, like, I know you don't have a clue who these 3 kids are that you sired and forgot about 12 or 13 years ago, but don't worry, Dad, I got you. Jerry was from London, Gracie from Idaho, and Jan from Hong Kong. When had I been in Hong Kong? All 3 seemed stunned to meet me, but more in a you-have-to-be-kidding-me way, not in a wow-cool sort of way. I muttered some apologies about being a terrible father. The newcomers exchanged glances and apparently decided, by silent agreement, to put me out of my misery.
I'm famished, Jerry said.
Yeah, Gracie said. Dining hall!
And off we trekked like one big, super awkward family. Campers from other cabins were also streaming toward the dining pavilion. I spotted Meg halfway up the hill, chatting excitedly with her siblings from the Demeter cabin. At her side trotted Peaches, her fruit tree spirit companion. The little diapered fellow seemed quite happy, alternately flapping his leafy wings and grabbing Meg's leg to get her attention. We hadn't seen Peaches since Kentucky, as he tended to only show up in natural settings, or when Meg was in dire trouble, or when breakfast was about to be served. Meg and I had been together so long, usually just the 2 of us, that I felt a pang in my heart watching her stroll along with a different set of friends. She looked so content without me. If I ever made it back to Mount Olympus, I wondered if she would decide to stay at Camp Half-Blood. I also wondered why the thought made me so sad. After the horrors she'd suffered in Nero's imperial household, she deserved some peace. That made me think about my dream of Lugu Selwa, battered and broken on a stretcher in front of Nero's throne. Perhaps I had more in common with the Gaul than I wanted to admit. Meg needed a better family, a better home than either Lu or I could give her. But that didn't make it any easier to contemplate letting her go. Just ahead of us, a boy of about 9 stumbled from the Ares cabin. His helmet had completely swallowed his head. He ran to catch up to his cabin mates. The point of his 2 long sword tracing a serpentine line in the dirt behind him. The newbies all look so young, Will murmured. Were we ever that young? Kayla and Austin nodded in agreement. Jan grumbled.
We newbies are right here.
I wanted to tell them that they were all so young. Their lifespans were a blink of an eye compared to my 4 millennia. I should be wrapping them all in warm blankets and giving them cookies, rather than expecting them to be heroes, slay monsters, and buy me clothes. On the other hand, Achilles hadn't even started shaving yet when he sailed off to the Trojan War. I'd watched so many young heroes march bravely to their deaths over the centuries. Just thinking about it made me feel older than Cronus's teething ring. After the relatively ordered meals of the 12th Legion at Camp Jupiter, breakfast at the dining pavilion was quite a shock. Counselors tried to explain the seating rules, such as they were, while returning campers jockeyed for spots next to their friends. And the newbies tried not to kill themselves or each other with their new weapons. Dryads wove through the crowd with platters of food, satyrs trotting behind them and stealing bites. Honeysuckle vines bloomed on the Greek columns, filling the air with perfume. At the sacrificial fire, demigods took turns scraping parts of their meals into the flames as offerings to the gods. Cornflakes, bacon, toast, yogurt. Yogurt? A steady plume of smoke rolled into the heavens. As a former god, I appreciated the sentiment. But I also wondered whether the smell of burning yogurt was worth the air pollution. Will offered me a seat next to him, then passed me a goblet of orange juice. Thank you, I managed. But where's, I scanned the crowd for Nico D'Angelo, remembering how he normally sat at Will's table, regardless of cabin rules. Up there, Will said, apparently guessing my thoughts. The son of Hades sat next to Dionysus at the head table. The god's plate was piled high with pancakes. Nico's was empty. They seemed an odd pair, sitting together. But they appeared to be in a deep and serious conversation. Dionysus rarely tolerated demigods at his table. If he was giving Nico such undivided attention, something must be seriously wrong. I remembered what Mr. D had said yesterday, just before I passed out. That boy has had too much bad news already, I repeated, then frowned at Will. What did that mean? Will picked at the wrapper of his bran muffin. It's complicated. Nico sensed Jason's death weeks ago. It sent him into a rage. I'm so sorry. It's not your fault, Will assured me. When you got here, you just confirmed what Nico already knew. The thing is, Nico lost his sister Bianca a few years back. He spent a long time raging about that. He wanted to go into the underworld to retrieve her, which, I guess, as a son of Hades, he's really not supposed to do. Anyway, he was finally starting to come to terms with her death. Then he learned about Jason, the first person he really considered a friend. It triggered a lot of stuff for him. Nico has traveled to the deepest parts of the underworld, even down in Tartarus. The fact that he came through it in one piece is a miracle. With his sanity intact, I agreed. Then I looked again at Dionysus, god of madness, who seemed to be giving Nico advice. Oh. Yeah, Will agreed, his face drawn with worry. They've been eating most meals together, though Nico doesn't eat much these days. Nico has been having, I guess you'd call it post-traumatic stress disorder. He gets flashbacks. He has waking dreams. Dionysus is trying to help him make sense of it all. The worst part is the voices. A dryad slammed a plate of huevos rancheros in front of me, almost making me jump out of my jeans. She smirked and walked off, looking quite pleased with herself. Voices? I asked Will. Will turned up his palms. Nico won't tell me much. Just someone in Tartarus keeps calling his name. Someone needs his help. It's been all I could do to stop him from storming down into the underworld by himself. I told him, talk to Dionysus first. Figure out what's real and what's not. Then, if he has to go, we'll go together. A rivulet of cold sweat trickled between my shoulder blades. I couldn't imagine Will in the underworld. A place with no sunshine, no healing, no kindness. I hope it doesn't come to that, I said. Will nodded. Maybe if we can take down Nero, maybe that will give Nico something else to focus on for a while. Assuming we can help you. Kayla had been listening quietly, but now she leaned in. Yeah, Meg was telling us about this prophecy you got. The Tower of Nero and all that. If there's a battle, we want in. Austin wagged a breakfast sausage at me. Word. Their willingness to help made me feel grateful. If I had to go to war, I would want Kayla's bow at my side. Will's healing skill might keep me alive, despite my best efforts to get killed. Austin could terrify our enemies with diminished minor riffs on his saxophone. On the other hand, I remembered Luguselwa's warning about Nero's readiness. He wanted us to attack.
A full frontal assault would be suicide. I would not let my children come to harm. Even if my only other option was to trust Lu's crazy plan and surrender myself to the Emperor. A 48-hour ultimatum, Nero had said in my dream. Then he would burn down New York. Gods, why wasn't there an option C on this multiple-choice test? Clink, clink, clink. Dionysus rose at the head table, a glass and spoon in his hands. The dining pavilion fell silent. Demigods turned and waited for morning announcements. I recalled Chiron having much more trouble getting everyone's attention. Then again, Chiron didn't have the power to turn the entire assembly into bunches of grapes. Mr. A and Will Solace, report to the head table, Dionysus said. The campers waited for more. That's all, Mr. D said. Honestly, do I need to tell you how to eat breakfast? Carry on. The campers resumed their normal, happy chaos. Will and I picked up our plates. Good luck, Kayla said. I have a feeling you'll need it. We went to join Dionysus and Nico at the International Head Table of Pancakes. 10. Huevos rancheros do not go with prophecies, much like happiness. Dionysus had not asked for Meg, but she joined us anyway. She plopped down next to me with her plate of flapjacks and snapped her fingers at Dionysus. Pass the syrup. I feared Mr. D might turn her into a taxidermied back end for Seymour. But he simply did as she asked. I suppose he didn't want to polymorph the only other person at camp who liked Pinochle. Peaches stayed behind at the Demeter table, where he was getting fawned over by the campers. This was just as well, since grape gods and peach spirits don't mix. Will sat next to Nico and put an apple on his empty plate. Eat something. Nico said, though he leaned into Will ever so slightly. Right. Dionysus held up a cream-colored piece of stationery between his fingers, like a magician producing a card. This came for me last night via Harpy Courier. He slid it across the table so I could read the fancy print. Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus requests the pleasure of your company at the burning of the Greater New York Metropolitan Area 48 hours after receipt of this invitation. Unless the former god Apollo, now known as Lester Papadopoulos, surrenders himself before that time to imperial justice at the Tower of Nero. In which case, we will just have cake. Gifts, only expensive ones, please. RSVP, don't bother. If you don't show up, we'll know. I pushed away my huevos rancheros. My appetite had vanished. It was one thing to hear about Nero's diabolical plans in my nightmares. It was another thing to see them spelled out in black and white calligraphy with a promise of cake. 48 hours from last night, I said. Yes, Dionysus mused. I've always liked Nero. He has panache. Meg stabbed viciously at her pancakes. She filled her mouth with fluffy, syrupy goodness, probably to keep herself from muttering curse words. Nico caught my gaze across the table. His dark eyes swam with anger and worry. On his plate, the apples started to wither. Will squeezed his hand. Hey, stop. Nico's expression softened a bit. The apple stopped its premature slide into old age. Sorry. I'm tired of talking about problems I can't fix. I want to help. He said help as if it meant chop our enemies into small pieces.
Nico D'Angelo wasn't physically imposing like Sherman Yang. He didn't have Reyna Ramirez Arellano's air of authority, or Hazel Levesque's commanding presence when she charged into battle on horseback. But Nico wasn't someone I would ever want as an enemy. He was deceptively quiet. He appeared anemic and frail. He kept himself on the periphery. But Will was right about how much Nico had been through. He had been born in Mussolini's Italy. He had survived decades in the time warp reality of the Lotus Casino. He'd emerged in modern times disoriented and culture shocked, arrived at Camp Half-Blood, and promptly lost his sister Bianca to a dangerous quest. He had wandered the labyrinth in self-imposed exile, being tortured and brainwashed by a malevolent ghost. He'd overcome everyone's distrust and emerge from the Battle of Manhattan as a hero. He'd been captured by giants during the rise of Gia. He'd wandered Tartarus alone and somehow managed to come out alive. And through it all, he'd struggled with his upbringing as a conservative Catholic Italian male from the 1930s and finally learned to accept himself as a young gay man. Anyone who could survive all that had more resilience than Stygian iron. "We do need your help," I promised. "Meg told you about the prophetic verses?"
"Meg told Will," Nico said. "Will told me. Terzarima, like in Dante. We had to study him in elementary school in Italy. Gotta say, I never thought it would come in handy."
Will poked at his bran muffin. "Just so I'm clear, you got the first stanza from a cyclops's armpit, the second from a two-headed snake, and the third from three old ladies who drive a taxi." "We didn't have much choice in the matter," I said. "But yes."
"Does the poem ever end?" Will asked. "If the rhyme scheme interlocks stanza to stanza, couldn't it keep going forever?"
I shuddered. "I hope not. Usually the last stanza would include a closing couplet, but we haven't heard one yet."
"Which means," Nico said, "that there are more stanzas to come."
"Yippee!" Meg shoved more pancake in her mouth. Dionysus matched her with a mouthful of his own, as if they were engaged in a competition to see who could devour the most and enjoy it the least. "Well then," Will said with forced cheerfulness, "let's discuss the stanzas we have. What was it? The Tower of Nero to alone ascend. That part is obvious enough. It must mean Apollo and Meg, right?"
"We surrender," Meg said. "That's Lugus Elwa's plan."
Dionysus snorted.
"Apollo, please tell me you're not going to trust a Gaul. You haven't gotten that addle-brained, have you?"
"Hey," Meg said, "we can trust Lou. She let Lester throw her off a roof."
Dionysus narrowed his eyes.
"Did she survive?"
Meg looked flustered.
"I mean..."
"Yes," I interrupted. "She did." I told them what I had seen in my dreams. The broken Gaul brought before Nero's throne. The Emperor's ultimatum. Then my plunge into the caverns beneath Delphi, where Python blessed my tiny brain. Dionysus nodded thoughtfully.
"Ah, yes, Python. If you survive Nero, you have that to look forward to."
I didn't appreciate the reminder. Stopping a power-mad emperor from taking over the world and destroying a city, that was one thing. Python was a more nebulous threat, harder to quantify, but potentially 1,000 times more dangerous. Meg and I had freed 4 oracles from the grasp of the triumvirate, but Delphi still remained firmly under Python's control. That meant the world's main source of prophecy was being slowly choked off, poisoned, manipulated. In ancient times, Delphi had been called the Omphalos, the navel of the world. Unless I managed to defeat Python and retake the Oracle, the entire fate of humanity was at risk. Delphic prophecies were not simply glimpses into the future. They shaped the future. And you did not want an enormous, malevolent monster controlling a wellspring of power like that, calling the shots for all human civilization. I frowned at Dionysus. You could always, decide to help. He scoffed.
You know as well as I do, Apollo, that quests like this are demigod business. As for advising, guiding, helping, that's really more Chiron's job. He should be back from his meeting, tomorrow night, I would think. But that will be too late for you.
I wished he hadn't put it that way. Too late for you. What meeting? Meg asked.
Dionysus waved the question away. Some joint task force, he called it. The world often has more than one crisis happening at a time, perhaps you've noticed. He said he had an emergency meeting with a cat and a severed head, whatever that means.
So instead we get you, Meg said.
Believe me, child, I would rather not be here with you delightful rapscallions either. After I was so helpful in the wars against Kronos and Gaia, I was hoping Zeus might grant me early parole from my servitude in this miserable place. But, as you can see, he sent me right back to complete my 100 years. Our father does love to punish his children.
He gave me that smirk again. The one that meant, at least you got it worse. I wished Chiron was here. But there was no point in dwelling on that, or on whatever the old centaur might be up to at his emergency meeting. We had enough to worry about on our own. Python's words kept slithering around in my brain.
You never look at the whole board.
The evil reptile was playing a game inside a game. No great surprise that he would be using the triumvirate for his own purposes. But Python seemed to relish the idea that I might kill his last ally, Nero. And after that?
A few hours at most. That is all it will take once the last pawn falls.
I had no idea what that meant. Python was right that I couldn't see the whole board. I didn't understand the rules. I just wanted to sweep the pieces away and shout, "I'm going home!" Whatever. Meg poured more syrup onto her plate in an effort to create Lake Pancake.
Point is, that other line says our lives depend on Nero's own. That means we can trust Lou. We'll surrender before the deadline, like she told us.
Nico tilted his head.
Even if you do surrender, what makes you think Nero will honor his word? If he's gone to all the trouble to rig enough Greek fire to burn down New York, why wouldn't he just do it anyway?
He would, I said. Most definitely. Dionysus seemed to ponder this.
But these fires wouldn't extend as far as, say, Camp Half-Blood?
Dude, Will said.
What? The god asked. I am only in charge of the safety of this camp.
Lou has a plan, Meg insisted. Once we're captured, Nero will relax his guard. Lou will free us. We'll destroy...
She hesitated.
We'll destroy his fasces. Then he'll be weak. We can beat him before he burns the city.
I wondered if anyone else had caught her change of direction. The way she'd felt too uncomfortable to say, "We'll destroy Nero." At the other tables, campers continued eating breakfast, jostling each other good-naturedly, chatting about the day's scheduled activities. None of them paid much attention to our conversation. No one was glancing nervously at me
and asking their cabin mates if I was really the god Apollo. Why would they? This was a new generation of demigods, just starting their first summer at camp. For all they knew, I was a normal fixture of the landscape, like Mr. D, the satyrs, and ritual yogurt burnings. Mr. A? Oh yeah, he used to be a god or something. Just ignore him. Many times over the centuries, I had felt out of date and forgotten. Never more so than at that moment. If Lou is telling the truth, Will was saying, and if Nero still trusts her.
And if she can break you out,
Nico added.
And if you can destroy the Fasces before Nero burns down the city. That's a lot of ifs. I don't like scenarios with more than one if.
Like I might take you out for pizza this weekend, Will offered, if you're not too annoying.
Exactly.
Nico's smile was a bit of winter sun breaking between snow flurries. So assuming you guys go through with this crazy plan, what are we supposed to do? Meg belched.
It's right there in the prophecy. The son of Hades thing.
Nico's face clouded over.
What son of Hades thing?
Will developed a sudden interest in his bran muffins wrapper. Nico seemed to realize, at the same time I did, that Will hadn't shared all the lines of the prophecy with him.
William Andrew Solace, Nico said. Do you have something to confess?
I was going to mention it. Will looked at me pleadingly, as if he couldn't make himself say the lines. The son of Hades, cavern runner's friend, I recited, must show the secret way unto the throne. Nico scowled with such intensity I feared he might make Will wither like the apple. You think that might have been good to mention sooner?
Hold on,
I said, partly to spare Will from Nico's wrath, and partly because I had been racking my brain trying to think who these cavern runners might be, and I still had no clue. Nico, do you know what those lines mean?
Nico nodded. The cavern runners are new friends of mine.
They're hardly friends, Will muttered.
They're experts on subterranean geography, Nico said. I've been talking to them about other business.
Which is not good for your mental health,
Dionysus added in a sing-song voice. Nico gave him a death-to-apples look.
If there is a secret way into Nero's tower, they might know it.
Will shook his head.
Every time you visit them.
He let his statement die, but the concern in his voice was as jagged as broken glass.
Then come with me this time, Nico said. Help me.
Will's expression was miserable. I could tell he desperately wanted to protect Nico, to help him any way he could. He also desperately did not want to visit these cavern runners.
Who are they? Meg said, between bites of pancake. Are they horrible?
Yes, Will said.
No, Nico said.
Well, that's settled then,
Dionysus said,
since Mr. D'Angelo seems intent on ignoring my mental health advice and going on this quest.
That's not fair, Nico protested.
You heard the prophecy. I have to.
The whole concept of have to is strange to me, Dionysus said. But if your mind is made up, you'd best get going, eh? Apollo only has until tomorrow night to surrender, or fake surrender, or whatever you wish to call it.
Anxious to get rid of us? Meg asked.
Dionysus laughed.
And people say there are no stupid questions. But if you trust your friend, Lululemon...
Lugus Elwa,
Meg growled.
Whatever. Shouldn't you hurry back to her?
Nico folded his arms.
I'll need some time before we leave. If I want to ask my new friends a favor, I can't show up empty-handed.
Oh, ick, Will said. You're not going to...
Nico raised an eyebrow at him like, really, boyfriend? You're already in the doghouse. Will sighed. Fine, I'll go with you to gather supplies.
Nico nodded.
That'll take us most of the day. Apollo, Meg, how about you stay at camp and rest up for now?
The four of us can leave for the city first thing tomorrow morning. That should still give us enough time.
But...
My voice faltered. I wanted to protest, but I wasn't sure on what grounds. Only a day at Camp Half-Blood, before our final push toward destruction and death? That wasn't nearly enough time to procrastinate. I thought a quest had to be formally authorized.
I formally authorize it, Dionysus said.
But it can only be three people, I said.
Dionysus looked at Will, Nico, and me.
I'm only counting three.
Hey, Meg said. I'm coming too.
Dionysus pointedly ignored her.
We don't even have a plan, I said. Once we find this secret path, what do we do with it? Where do we start?
We start with Rachel, Will said, still picking glumly at his muffin.
A dare reveals the path that was unknown.
The truth pierced the base of my neck like an acupuncture needle.
Of course, Will's interpretation made total sense. Our old friend would probably be at home in Brooklyn,
just starting her summer break, not expecting me to crash her place and demand help.
Rachel Elizabeth Dare, I said. My Delphic priestess.
Excellent, Dionysus said. Now that you've got your suicidal quest figured out, can we please finish breakfast?
And stop hogging the syrup, McCaffrey. Other people have pancakes, too.
11. I apologize to my arrow and undies. And, well, everything. What would you do if you only had one day at Camp Half-Blood? Perhaps you'd partake in a game of Capture the Flag, or ride a Pegasus over the beach, or laze in the meadow enjoying the sunshine and the sweet fragrance of ripening strawberries. All good choices. I did none of them. I spent my day running around in a panic, trying to prepare myself for imminent death. After breakfast, Nico refused to share any more information about the mysterious cave runners.
You'll find out tomorrow,
was all he said. When I asked Will, he clammed up and looked so sad I didn't have the heart to press him. Dionysus probably could have enlightened me, but he'd already checked us off his to-do list.
I told you, Apollo, the world has many crises. Just this morning, scientists released another study tying soda to hypertension. If they continue to disparage the name of Diet Coke, I will have to smite someone.
He stormed off to plot his revenge on the health industry. I thought Meg at least would stay at my side as we got ready for our quest. Instead, she chose to spend her morning planting squash with the Demeter cabin. That's correct, dear reader. She chose ornamental gourds over me. My first stop was the Ares cabin, where I asked Sherman Yang if he had any helpful intel on Nero's tower.
It's a fortress, he said. A frontal attack would be...
Suicide, I guessed. No secret entrances?
Not that I know of. If there were, they'd be heavily guarded and set with traps.
He got a faraway look on his face.
Maybe motion-activated flamethrowers. That would be cool.
I began to wonder if Sherman would be more helpful as an advisor to Nero. Is it possible, I asked, that Nero could have a doomsday weapon in place? For instance, enough Greek fire to destroy New York at the push of a button?
Whoa.
Sherman developed the love-struck expression of someone seeing Aphrodite for the first time.
That would be amazing.
I mean, bad. That would be bad. But, yeah, it's possible. With his wealth and resources, the amount of time he's had to plan, sure. He'd need a central storage facility and a delivery system for rapid dispersal. My guess? It would be underground, to take advantage of the city's pipes, sewers, tunnels, and whatnot. You think he's really got something like that? When do we leave for battle? I realized I may have told Sherman Yang too much. I'll get back to you, I muttered, and beat a hasty retreat. Next up, the Athena cabin. I asked their current head counselor, Malcolm, if he had any information about the Tower of Nero, or creatures called cave runners, or any hypotheses about why a Gaul like Luguselwa might be working for Nero, and whether or not she could be trusted. Malcolm paced the cabin, frowning at various wall maps and bookshelves.
I could do some research, he offered. We could come up with a solid intelligence dossier and a plan of attack.
That would be amazing.
It'll take us about 4 weeks, maybe three if we push it. When do you have to leave?
I exited the cabin in tears. Before lunchtime, I decided to consult my weapon of last resort, the arrow of Dodona. I moved into the woods, thinking perhaps the arrow would be more prophetic if I brought it closer to its place of origin, the Grove of Dodona.